Okay, well, thank you for inviting me. It's great to be here to tell you about my recent work at the Institute for Quantum Computing. So some of the work I'll talk about will be from my postdoc, but I'll also talk about some recent work from building up my lab. And what we're developing are entangled photon sources, but on-demand entangled photon sources. And what that means on demand is when you push a button, then you get the pair when you ask for it. Just one pair, and not more than one pair. And not less than one pair. So that's the goal, to get every time you push a button, you get a photon pair that's entangled. And this is my artist impression. So I've superimposed my artist impression on an actual device, an SEM image of a single nanowire. And I'm showing the image where I expect the light to go. So we basically have a quantum dot embedded in the nanowire, and the quantum dot's used to emit the entangled photon pairs. So I'll show you how we actually generate the entangled pairs. And then the major problem was the light was going in all directions, but then we shaped this wire in a certain way to direct all the photons to the communication channel. So in this way, we can go towards the on-demand, where every time we emit a pair, we can also collect it.
Is it like parametric down conversion, but like the same basic principle, or?
No, so in parametric down conversion, it's a nonlinear crystal, and that's probabilistic. So when you go to high power, you get multiple pairs. But here, if you go to high power, you still get single pairs. Yeah, it's a dot. So we basically can find the electrons. But I have a slide on how that works. And then on the right here, you see an array of wires. So we have basically many, like thousands of these single nanowires on a chip that can emit entangled pairs. And we can position these exactly where we want them, so we can, have more than one on a chip. And this is indium phosphide nanowires, and the dot is indium arsenide. So this is a motivation slide where we're going from the optics lab to the nanoscale. So if we go over 30 years ago, where we look at famous physicist Alain Aspect, where he generated entangled photon pairs with this large optical laboratory, where he had, say, a 10-meter laser, this big tube where he had calcium atoms, and he was using the radiative cascade in calcium atoms to generate entangled pairs. And now, decades later, we generate entangled photons just with a single nanowire. And in principle, so we also use a laser now in the experiments we're doing now, but since it's semiconductor technology, we can also in the future now make p-n junctions, and then we could electrically drive the entangled photons. And just to give you an idea, so I'm going to compare quantum dot sources to parametric down conversion, just to give you a flavor on what we're working towards. So I've plotted the fidelity to a maximally entangled state. So this is 100% is perfect entanglement. And then what we want to be on demand is we want a photon pair efficiency of 1. So that means every time we trigger the source, we generate the pair, but then also collect it for our communication channel. And so we want to be in this region here to say it's on demand. So this dotted dashed line, this is the threshold that you need to violate the Bell's inequality. So you have to be above that line to violate the Bell's inequality. And so what I first plotted is all the parametric down conversion sources in these blue squares. This is the state of the art, and this has been a workhorse for quantum optics experiments. So you can see at very low photon pair efficiency, and I define that as the probability of collecting a photon pair per excitation pulse at the first lens. And so you can see they have perfect entanglement fidelity almost, but at a source efficiency less than 1e^-3 or less than 1%. And this, you can easily get a higher photon rate, but as soon as you start pumping harder, you get multi-photon emission, and that's why the entanglement fidelity is dropping. as you go to higher rates. So that they can never theoretically get to this on-demand region. And now quantum dots, they're promised to be on-demand. And that's what we always say.
What is the reason that they get damaged? Is it because they emit more than one pair?
Yeah, so it only goes down because they start emitting multiple pairs. So basically, because it parametric non-conversion follows Poissonian statistics. So to get the high fidelity, you go at a low photon rate. So you basically, not 95% of the time you have no pairs. So you have to operate at low power. And then as you start increasing the probability, then you start getting increased probability for multiple pairs. And then it starts dropping.
Is there any opportunity to do entanglement purification to try to improve these sorts of sources? So, you know, theoretically, if I have a large number of poorly entangled states, I can distill out a few highly entangled states.
Yeah, I think so. I'm not very familiar with that, but I think you can do that, yeah.
So in principle, you could hope to boost up those guys, but it would probably involve a certain overhead in processing. Take your rate down by whatever the.
Yeah. So whenever you're post selecting, you bring down the rates. Yeah. So basically, this is the state of the art. So, you know, you can maybe get to 10% and still violate Bell's inequality. And now quantum dots, they promise to be on demand, but actually, the quantum dot is in a high refractive index material, so the photons emit in all directions. And so I took all the state-of-the-art quantum dot sources, and actually you see they're all below parametric down conversion. So even though you say they're on demand, every time you excite them, they emit a photon, but then you don't collect the photon, so then it's not very useful. So you can see this was the earlier works with quantum dots, and now later works were up here, where now we can violate Bell's inequality. And this was my work in my postdoc, using the nanowire, but now I'm going to show you, in today's talk, I'm going to show you where I am in this region.
We learn that at the end, where the dot ends up.
Yes. And so the motivation to create the entangled pairs is long-distance quantum communication using the E91 Eckert protocol. And then what we're also working towards in my group is towards a quantum repeater. So we want to be able to take more than one source that's emitting entangled pairs. And we want to be able to do a Bell state measurement to be able to do entanglement swapping. And that's a building block of a quantum repeater. So that's one thing we're working towards. And another thing that's nice about these nanowires is we have a new resource for on-chip quantum optics, where you want to do quantum algorithms on a chip using single photons. So we can actually take the nanowire from our grow substrate. So this is a image of a tungsten tip. And the tip has about the same diameter of the nanowire, so 200 nanometers. And then with van der Waals forces, you can just pick up the nanowire, and then you can put it where you want it on a silicon chip. So that's what you see here. So you see here the nanowire on the tip. And then we put it on a silicon chip that has a thin layer of silicon oxide. That's what you see is the gray. And then we actually etch these waveguides around the nanowire waveguide. And then we have a photonic channel on the chip. And then you can make more complex architectures. But this is just the proof of principle that where we can have single photons coming from the nanowire along this waveguide channel. And then we can do quantum optics with that.
Is the nanowire lying on its side? Because yeah, so the earlier picture had them kind of standing up on it.
So there it was standing up. And when it's standing, we collect the light from this direction. But now when we have it on the chip, then we direct it in waveguides on the chip.
And so it really just does lie on its side.
Yeah, you lie it on the side. And then the idea here is we actually going to encapsulate this with a waveguide. So it'll be all surrounded by waveguide, silicon nitride. And then you have a very high coupling from the nanowire to the waveguide channel. And then you can put beam splitters on the chip and filters and everything you need to do this KLM scheme.
And are you going to talk about how the nanowire with the quantum dot is itself fabricated?
Yes. Yeah. And then just so we can make many of these in a row. So if we want to make multi-photon entangled states on a chip, we also have a route to do that. But we're just at the initial stages where we can place our sources and make a waveguide channel around it. And we get high coupling between the quantum light source and the photonic channel. So what are some of the advantages of these dots and nanowires? So they're, because you have a waveguide, you can have a high collection efficiency. So I say they're bright and pure. And then so they're pure, meaning the single photon purity is perfect. So here you can see a G2, where we see near zero time delay, we see no multi-photon emission. So that's telling you your photon source is pure.
What's the time delay in?
So this is in nanoseconds. So we come with a pulse every 12.5 nanoseconds. And so these are the uncorrelated. This is basically the laser pulses.
So within a certain time window, then uncorrelated.
Yeah, then you expect for a single photon source, no coincidences at zero time delay. So you basically send a single photon to a beam splitter, and then the photon either goes to one detector or the other detector. And you do coincidence between them, and basically if it's a pure single photon source, you expect no coincidences here. So that's why you see nothing here. So if you had a little peak here, then that would tell you have multi-photon emission. And what else the advantage of the nanowire is that it actually, and I'll tell you how this happens, is that we get a very nice Gaussian mode. And this is very good for coupling to a communication channel like an optical fiber for long-distance communications. So we actually showed that we can couple almost over 95% to an optical fiber for the communication channel. And then we also have coherent photons, so on the order of 1 nanosecond. And this is very useful if you want to do 2-photon interference for the quantum repeater. You need very, very coherent photons. And the other thing that's important for the entangled photons is that we have basically, because we have instead of a cavity, we have a waveguide. So cavities are very narrow band, so you can't extract both photon pairs very, very efficiently. With a waveguide, it's very broad band, so we can get both frequencies of the entangled pair. And I'll explain more about this in my talk. So what does it mean to be on demand? So we generate the photons with a quantum dot. So we basically have a low band gap material embedded in a high band gap. So we use indium arsenide embedded in indium phosphide. So this is a schematic view of the potential of the quantum dot. And basically, we can come with a laser pulse. We can come above the nanowire band gap. And we can generate electrons and holes inside the quantum dot. And you can see these are the quantized energy levels, similar to the 2D harmonic oscillator. So then what happens is these now recombine in a cascade process, starting at the higher energy state. And then due to the strong Coulomb interactions, each one of these states emits at a different energy. And basically, you can see now this bi-exciton state, which I label 2x, is 2 electrons and 2 holes. And this is basically what's used for the entangled pair. So you have a spin singlet in the ground state, and you don't know which electron is recombining first. It's either spin up or spin down. So since you don't know which is recombining first, this is where the entanglement is generated. So first you would have the red photon, and then the blue photon. And then it's on demand because basically when this last photon recombines, the dot is empty, and it can't emit another photon until it's re-excited. So every time it's emitting these pair of photons, and the exciton comes directly after the bi-exciton. And what we do then is we then filter these two frequencies for the entanglement.
Can you explain why there's a difference in the frequency of the emission? Because in your diagram, it looks like they're coming from the same energy level difference.
Yeah, so it's actually, they are at the same energy level. But so in this case, when you have 2 electrons, 2 holes, mm-hmm. you have this electron hole pair recombining in the presence of the other electron hole pair. And due to those Coulomb interactions, it shifts it to lower energy just by a couple of millielectron volts. And then when the last one recombines, there's no electron hole pair, so then it just emits there.
Okay. Yeah. So when you draw them red and blue, that's just they're actually
Yeah,
millielectron volts apart.
millielectron volts apart. Yeah, so here's an actual spectrum. So you can see here, where in this case, you have a more complicated spectrum. So you see many lines, and you see these two lines here, where you have the exciton and biexciton. These are the two lines that we're interested in. These are making the entangled photons. And this one over here is when you have two electrons in one hole. That's a charged exciton. And actually, this is bad for us when we have this one, because it basically takes photons away from our entangled pair. Because you can have electrons tunneling in and out of the dot, and that will take photons away from this exciton. Because say if you have this, basically if you would have this recombine, and then another electron tunnels in, you would have two electrons in one hole, and then you would have this emission line instead of this one, and that would reduce your source efficiency. So this is we want to reduce this process from happening. And we have ways to do that. You can use electric field to sweep the charges away, or we can make the nanowire thicker to suppress the tunneling. Or we can even tune our energy of the laser so that we come, instead of going above the band gap of the wire, we can then tune resonant into these energy levels. And that reduces these charges. And so one thing that we said quantum dots promised to be on demand is because they were known for a long time that at cryogenic temperatures, they have near unity quantum efficiency. So that's the internal quantum efficiency. When you excite it, it emits a photon. So deterministic source, yes?
So when you have an entangled pair, there's no kind of spectral entanglement problem? Like...
So they're entangled in polarization?
They're not entangled in frequency a little bit as well?
No, because they're at different frequencies.
Sure, but there are some Gaussian wave packets, right? So it's kind of, they're not perfect frequencies, but they can still be, since they have a sum of different frequencies, there could still be some entanglement with those a little bit, right?
So there's a way you can do that. No one's shown that. If you make these two frequencies the same of the exciton and biexciton, you can actually tune them to the same energy, and then you would expect entangled photons. But no one has shown that. But theoretically, it was shown.
How would you do that, given that, like you said earlier, the first pair recombined in the presence of the second pair?
So you can manipulate the binding energies of these electrons and holes with, say, electric field, and you can actually make those two the same frequency.
Basically, the first pair doesn't see the second pair.
So it's by actually separating the electron hole far enough apart that your biexciton becomes unbound. So you have two separated excitons. Yeah, so like what you're saying, that it doesn't see it. Yeah. It's another way of thinking about it. And so now, how do we generate the entanglement? So I said they're entangled, but how is it generated? So we start, I have an energy diagram here, where we start with the biexciton state, where we have two electrons and two holes. So I represent the electrons with blue and the holes by red. So now, depending on which spin configuration recombines, say we take the spin up electron with the spin down hole, we'll get left circularly polarized light. Then you're left with this one. And this gives you has the opposite spin, so we get right circularly polarized light. And basically, we have two recombination pathways. So if the other one recombines, then we get right and then left. And these two pathways are indistinguishable. And so what we end up with is we're entangled. We get this Bell state where we're entangled in the polarization degrees of freedom, where we get RL plus LR. And so that's how the entanglement is generated. And basically, you can rewrite this Bell state, also HH plus VV. And so now a major problem with quantum dots now is for this to be entangled, these two exciton states have to be degenerate. So if these are not the same energy, then each photon in this cascade will have a different color, and you will destroy the entanglement. So I show that here on the right. So if you have a small splitting here, you will see each photon gives a different color, and you're no longer entangled. So you have some phase, and if this phase is large enough, you will basically destroy your entangled state.
do you write horizontal and vertical in the second diagram as opposed to like, that, wouldn't it still be left, right, right, left, but just with different frequencies?
So it actually turns to linear polarization just because these two states are coupled via spin orbit interaction. So as the electrons orbiting inside the dot, you have an effective magnetic field. And this creates a coupling between these two states. And that actually makes you go to these linear polarizations. So this is the pure optical selection rules when you have these the same energy. But as soon as you split these, then they become linear. And you can actually see that in an experiment where you say, look at first, if you have this splitting, you can do correlation measurements between the Bayekstan and Exton, and say you would start on the Bayekstan photon. When you stop on the Exton photon, you would see they're correlated HH or VV, but then you would switch basis into the circular basis, and then they would not be correlated. Whereas when they're entangled, you see here they're correlated in the circular basis, but you would also be correlated in the horizontal vertical basis and the diagonal. That's a signature of entanglement. And in this case, you would just see they're classically correlated because you know the exton comes after the biexton, but then because of the splitting, there's no entanglement. And this splitting is actually caused by, say, the dot's not perfectly symmetric, or you have some strain from the dot material in the surrounding material, or even if the atoms are not symmetric inside if there's some defects, this can create this splitting. So this is a major problem to overcome in the quantum dots. And it actually turns out with the nanowires, they actually have this nice symmetry. And you have a very low splitting here where you can have the entanglement. So we're more in this situation. I mean, another way.
It is really entangled, it's just that there are frequencies are different in each term. Is that right?
So yeah, you're right. So you can think if...
So when you make measurements, you'll have which way information is.
That's right. So if you think of the Heisenberg uncertainty principle, if you measure fast enough, yeah, then this is also an entangled state. Right. But the problem is if this splitting is too large, then the precession between this one and this one is too fast, and you won't be able to measure it.
Oh, I see.
Yeah. So you basically want to measure faster than this splitting. And basically, you can think of it that your exciton is processing from this state to that state, and it actually comes back again. Yeah. And actually, the recent experiments that we've done in the last few weeks, we actually can follow the precession of the entanglement. We see oscillations between psi plus and psi minus. Mm-hmm. So we actually see this evolve.
What's the time scale?
1.2 nanoseconds.
Which is slow by...
Yeah, that's slow, yeah. Because our exciton lifetime is about 800 picoseconds. So that's slow compared to the lifetime.
So you said it depends how quickly you measure it, but you know, the recombination is a spontaneous process. You're ultimately just going to measure the photons after they've emitted. So what do you mean when you say if you've measured that quickly enough?
You can post-select on the photons. So you can, say, take a time window of 500 picoseconds and say, I only take these photons. Your entanglement fidelity will go higher than if you take the whole window where all your photons are emitting.
Okay.
But it turns out like 40% of the photons are emitted in the first 500 picoseconds. So then you don't care if it's oscillating on a 1 nanosecond scale. So is that clear how the entanglements, how we generate it? So there's two problems now. So we talked about this fine structure splitting that's destroying the entanglement. And these are the reasons you can cause by strain, dot shape, or the composition. And the other problem is that, you know, the dot's embedded in a high refractive index material. So in that case, the photons are emitted in all directions. And also when the photon comes here, at this semiconductor air interface, you can also have total internal reflection. So then your efficiency is limited to 1% per photon at best. So if you do the pair, then your efficiency for the pair would be 0.01 efficiency for the entangled pair. And this is what I was plotting for the quantum dot sources, were about 0.01%. And they said they were on demand, but this was the efficiency. So the first problem we overcome is with nanowire quantum dots. So we embed the quantum dot in the nanowire. And it was predicted in 2009 that if you grow these wires along this growth direction, you would have a very nice symmetry, and you would have entangled photons based on their symmetry. And they say ideal sources of entangled photon pairs. But when we go to the lab, actually what we see these oscillations between the two exciton states, and we measure a fine structure splitting on the order of 1 microEV. But this, it turns out this splitting is small enough that you can observe entanglement, so the precession is slow enough that you can observe entanglement. And we can look at a series of quantum dots in nanowires, so we looked at 16 of them, and we saw that more than 50% of the quantum dots had a fine structure splitting less than 2 microEV. So you can think about 50% of our dots in the nanowires are entangled. So these ones would not be entangled, whereas these ones would be entangled.
Some of the dots are working well and some are not. Is that
yeah.
So you just keep trying and get ones to work well.
So you saw from this paper, they expected the fine structure splitting to be zero. But we actually measure one, and that's because if you take the atoms in the dot and you just randomly position them, that will give you a small fine structure splitting on the order of a few microEV. So you don't get zero. Yeah. But this is low enough to observe entanglement.
Can you explain again how the location of the atoms affects the fine structure splitting?
So it just gives you an asymmetric potential. So you actually have to have everything symmetric. So if there's some, you know, asymmetry along the growth direction, that will give you a fine structure splitting. The easiest way to think about it is if, say, you have an elongated dot, so like if you just elongate it this way, then you know.
What's the axis of the nanowire?
Well, I mean, this is the top view.
Okay.
So this would be a perfectly symmetric one, and then you know your V and H would be the same, whereas in this case you see, you know, H is different than V. So it's not the same size. I guess I could have elongated it this way to make it more dramatic. And then if this is the dot shape, then your confining potential will not be symmetric, and then you will get these splittings between your exciton state. So actually, these nanowires, though, they're not circular symmetric, they're hexagonal symmetry. But it works the same. As long as it's symmetric, it will be.
And so the defects that you're referring to are just, they're not exactly hexagonal, there's deviation, is that what you mean?
No, so
just
the
an example.
No, so that's just an example. So in our case, it's actually the positioning of the arsenic atoms inside the dot are not perfectly symmetric in the crystal structure. And that will give you a few microEV.
You mean like the positioning of the actual impurities in the material is relevant to?
Yeah, yeah. So people have done many body atomistic calculations, and they see that just putting the atoms randomly in the crystal structure gives you this splitting. Yeah. But you can tune the splitting with electric field also. So we're working on that. But for now, we're just looking for the ones that have these low fine structure splitting. So the second problem is how do we get the photons out efficiently? So we embed the quantum dot in this nano waveguide. So there's three important parameters to this design to remember. So we have the dot in this waveguide section. So the dot will couple to this fundamental waveguide mode. So then you have this Gaussian fundamental waveguide mode propagating in this nano waveguide. So it basically propagates both upwards and downwards. I'm just showing the upwards mode. And then the second part of the design, now we have this taper towards the tip. And what this does is it takes the mode from inside the wire, and it basically your the effective refractive index is slowly changing to the tip. So the mode goes from inside to outside. And by the time it gets to the tip, the mode is maybe 1 micron compared to a 20 nanometer tip. So then you basically avoid the problem of total internal reflection at this semiconductor air interface. And you also see that you have a Gaussian mode. And basically, if you do the Fourier transform, the Gaussian mode will be also a Gaussian in the far field. So that's another advantage. And now, so we have this very directional emission. And what's nice about this waveguide is that the quantum dot couples with a 95% efficiency to the waveguide mode. And then if you make this adiabatic, you have no losses as the mode propagates along the nanowire. And so the only other thing you have to think about now is you also have to worry about the photons that are going downwards. You also want to reflect them towards the tip. So you would want to put a mirror there. And what's important for entangled photon pairs is you want both frequencies. So normally with cavities, you can only enhance one of the emission modes. But with a waveguide, you can enhance both frequencies. And that's what I'm plotting here. I took from this paper in 2009. So I'm plotting what they plot in that paper is the spontaneous emission rate against as a function of the nanowire diameter. And it's normalized to the emission wavelength. And now what you can see is for very low d over lambda, that's for thin nanowires, you actually have no modes available to couple for the dot to couple to. So you have a very low coupling efficiency. But as soon as you start opening up the modes, as you make the nanowire diameter larger, you see this coupling to the HE11 mode, this fundamental waveguide mode, increases, where it reaches a maximum for about 250 nanometer diameter. And that's the diameter we have here. And then as you increase the diameter further, you see the coupling to this waveguide mode goes down. And then also the other thing that happens is this coupling to radiation modes is increasing. And this is basically coupling to other modes, say, propagating into vacuum. And so what you want to do is you want to maximize this ratio. So the coupling of this dot to this waveguide mode is given by PM, which is the purple curve, and over this gamma. So you want to minimize this one. And then you see that you have a very high efficiency over this broad wavelength range. And that's very good for the extracting very efficiently both bi-exciton and exciton. And so that's needed for the bright entangled photon source. Yeah?
So the blue line is meant to be the ratio of the purple to the red line?
Yes.
It doesn't, like if I look out near 0.3, I would have expected that ratio to go down significantly compared to near 0.25. But the blue line doesn't go down significantly.
Well, it's not completely this one divided by that one. It's this
PM
one
PM
over this
plus
that one. So,
oh, I see. Okay.
So basically, if you make this near zero, you'll see this ratio is one.
Yeah.
That's when you're minimizing this one. But as this starts increasing, then this decreases. Whereas on the other side, it decreases because PM is decreasing. Yeah. And it's basically 95% over, say, 70 nanometers wavelength. And our two photons are maybe two nanometers apart. And as I also mentioned, is we get this very nice Gaussian emission profile. So this is a measured far field emission profile. And this is the calculated one. And they overlapped with 99%. So we have a very nice Gaussian emission mode. And so how does it work? So we look at the collection efficiency enhancement. We look on the far left where we have a dot and a thin nanowire. And here we see the two photons, the exciton and bi-exciton. Whereas on the far right, we see a case where we have a tapered nanowire with a dot and then also on a gold mirror. And we have a factor 10 times enhancement in the photoluminescence intensity as compared to when no waveguide was present. And then in the one in the middle is where we have waveguide and tapering, but no mirror. So you see with the mirror, we get a factor 2 enhancement as you would expect.
So see how this device, you've got some detectors, like where, at the top? Or?
Yeah, so we basically send the photons to a spectrometer, and then it goes off a grating, and we can resolve the wavelengths. So this is what you see. You see the spectrum here, and there's a CCD camera. And then once you would see this on a CCD camera, you would then send one line to an APD, single photon counter, and the other line to another single photon counter. And then you can do correlations between the two, photons.
At this stage, you're just looking at
them. Yeah, at this stage, we just look at the CCD camera, because then you can get nice information on the on the spectrum.
And the reason for the lower energy over here, your collection angle, or is it
no? In this case, they were just different dots.
All right.
Yeah. So we basically we didn't compare the exact same dot. We took the best dot from each sample.
Okay.
Yeah. And we also did some statistics, but here is just the best dot for each one.
Okay. But the point you're trying to make is that this is the best one where you have cavity and the mirror. So
yeah.
The waveguide and the mirror.
Yeah.
This one is better with tapering. And the reason is the collection, you collect more of the photons?
Yeah, so we collect more photons here because we have the waveguide and the tapering.
Right.
So we get the directional photon.
Okay.
Whereas in this case, it's less directional.
If you were to cover the entire thing with detector material, then you would have a higher efficiency.
So we actually have a high numerical aperture objective on top of the wire. So we collect all the photons that are emitted there. It's just in this case, the photons are going in all directions.
Okay,
and this one, in this case, it's going along the waveguide. So that's where the enhancement comes. But then you're losing photons that are directed downwards. So then we put a gold mirror, and then we get a factor two more. So in this work, we were just looking at the single photons, but now we're more interested in the entangled photon pairs. And so this is what we have more recently. So here you see a spectrum, and it's very clean now. So we only have the exciton, the biexciton, and here's the charged exciton. And then we did a power dependence on the single photon counter, and we look at the count rates. And we see that basically the exciton grows linearly, and the biexciton grows quadratically. And we expect that because the biexciton has two recombination pathways, so that's why you have a quadratic dependence. And we see they're both saturating at above a megahertz. So we have more than 1 million counts per second for each photon on the, and this is what we detect. You can also work out how many photons you have generated at your source by looking at the losses in your system. So we basically have 26 million biexciton photons and 43 million exciton photons. And the pair rate that we actually detect, we get 1 million per second. So now, just to give you this idea, compared to the previous work, we get a 1,000 times enhancement as compared to the bare quantum dot without the photonic nanostructure. So now we can do measurements now in 10 seconds that took us 10 hours before. Yeah.
So in the previous slide, you had a 10 time enhancement with the single photons relative to just the nanowire. And here, when you're saying compared to previous work, you don't have in mind the left-hand most alternative from your previous slide. You have in mind.
So we're actually the first entangled source in a photonic structure.
Oh.
So you have in mind.
So we have in mind.
No.
No quantum dots in just say in gallium arsenide. Where the photons go in all directions, and their efficiency is 1% per photon. So when you do the pair, it's 0.01%. And now we're on the order of 20%, which is still not the theoretical maximum yet, but we're at 20%. So I'm quite amazed by this now that we're factor 1,000 times. So we're not even at the theoretical maximum yet. So if you actually look at what the theoretical maximum would be, so there's two main things that you should remember. We have the tapering angle of the wire, which we call this angle alpha. And it turns out the smaller you make this tapering angle, the transmission in the wire goes to unity. So you actually want a tapering angle less than 2 degrees. And this is actually what we have with the nanowires. We have a tapering angle of 1 degree. So we're here. And the other thing that you need is you need the dot on the axis of the wire. And what that means is if you have the dot on the axis, you have near 100% coupling efficiency. And as soon as you move the dot to the left or right of along this way, then you see the coupling efficiency drops rapidly. And so these two things need to be satisfied. And so if you take these three design characteristics where you have a 1 degree nanowire taper, an on-axis quantum dot, and a perfect mirror below, you would expect 97% extraction efficiency, whereas we're measuring on the order of 20%. So we're still not even at the theoretical maximum. And so that's the theoretical maximum. So I would say with future structures, it would be possible to get more than 90%.
You mentioned that your tapering angle is down at 1%. So does that mean the place for improvement is on deviations from on-axis and imperfections in the mirror? Or?
No, we actually have both these satisfied. We just don't have the mirror below. So in this work, we did have the mirror below, but then we actually had to coat the wires with a thin polymer and then peel them away. And it turns out that this polymer reduces the beta, like the coupling to the waveguide mode. So we were reducing that efficiency, even though we were collecting these downward emitted photons. We were losing it because of the, just so that we could peel the wires away and then deposit gold, because we can't grow the wires on gold. That's the problem. So right now we don't have gold, but now with this, our single efficiency rates are close to 50%. And then, so when you do 50 times 50, you're close to 25%.
So why do you use a mirror as opposed to something like a fiber grating type thing that the light will reflect in the band?
Because right now we're measuring our wires right on the gross substrate. So now we can put nothing there below. So we can only grow the wires on the semiconductor substrate.
So what I'm saying is that you've already fabricated the nanowire with the quantum dot in it.
Yes.
Put it on the substrate.
So yes.
So if you had a fiber grating on one end of the wire that acted like a mirror.
Are you thinking of the lying wire case?
Yeah.
Yeah, we could do that, yeah. So we've only recently been able to transfer the wires to this lying. So previously we had the wire standing.
Yes.
And there we couldn't process anything below unless we took the wires off the substrate.
I see.
And then we could put them here.
You're talking about removing them. You're talking about the one where the configuration where they were standing up.
Yeah, so we removed all of them, then we could deposit the gold on the backside. Uh-huh. But then they were in this polymer, which wasn't very nice to preserve the optical properties. But it did enhance the efficiency, because we got the downward emitted photons, but then it didn't bring us towards this theoretical maximum.
Right.
But still, it's nice. So we're at 20%. We're 1,000 times more than before, but we still have room to go factor 4 or 5 more. Yeah.
Yeah. That answers another question. So this business about putting the gold, it sounds like that's what the configuration where they're staying. The configuration they're lying down, do you have anything? Do you have a mirror at all in that configuration? You're saying that's something you did recently.
Yeah, we don't have a mirror there either.
Mirror, so.
But you can put like a Bragg grating on the other side, on the back side. Yeah.
And that's part of the process of fabricating the nanowire.
That would be post-processing. So you would fabricate the nanowire.
Okay.
You would pick it up, put it on another substrate.
And then on that substrate, you.
Then you would make what you're thinking of.
Okay. Yeah. So that's part of your plan.
Yeah, well, it's one of the plans, yeah. Not immediately, but it is on the in the works, yeah.
Okay.
So I can just now say how we make these nanowave guides, because you might be interested in how we do that. So we collaborate with the NRC in Ottawa, and they use e-beam lithography. And it's a two growth process. So actually they start with a self-aligned process where they put a gold particle and the opening of this silicon oxide mask. So basically this gold particle now is used to grow the nanowire by vapor liquid solid growth. So basically you shoot the atoms at the substrate. This is a top view. And the material will incorporate into this gold particle. And as it becomes saturated with the material, it will basically lift the gold particle and the wire will grow below this gold particle. And then it will look like this. So now you see this nanowire core in this circular opening. And then we grow the quantum dot halfway up this nanowire. So here you see the gold particle. And that's the nanowire. And this is indium phosphide. This is the silicon oxide around. And then this circle is the opening that's made for the waveguide shell. So we're going to grow the waveguide around this quantum dot and nanowire. So we can zoom in now to this nanowire. And you can see if we grow the dot close to the gold particle, here you see the change in contrast. This is actually where the dot is. So we control the dot diameter with the gold particle and the dot height with the growth time. So you actually can engineer the dot diameter and height just with these growth parameters. And that can control your emission energy.
So I'm not quite following it. You go back to the very beginning when you said you deposit, what are you depositing in the gold particle?
So here you have you put a gold particle in the center of this opening in the silicon oxide mask. So you have to etch. So actually you etch, it's actually self-aligned that the gold particle ends up in the center of this opening.
Because of static repulsion?
Well, the way the etching happens, it under etches.
Oh, I see.
So then you have this big circular opening and then you're left with this small gold particle in the middle. And the gold particle is what's defining the dot size.
Okay.
And that opening is defining the waveguide,
okay,
which we want to be 200 nanometers. And the dot is we want 20 nanometers.
But what's the process that causes, you said that the gold particle lifts off and you get a wire underneath it?
Oh, yeah. So that's when you are depositing the material. So the gold particle acts as a catalyst. So basically the material will incorporate in the gold particle, and once it becomes saturated, it goes below it, and then it lifts the gold particle.
I see. So
then it grows atomic layer by atomic layer.
I see.
Yeah. And it's
energetically favorable for the material to go underneath the gold
yes.
particle, and it just
yeah.
constantly reconfigures.
And it's the indium that gets incorporated in the gold particle, and the phosphine is coming from both sides, and when the indium comes with the indium, with the phosphine comes with the indium, then you get indium phosphide. So it's actually coming in the gas phase.
Oh.
So we have phosphine for the phosphorus, then we have arsine for the arsenic, and then the indium is trimethyl indium. But it's only the indium that gets incorporated into the gold particle. And the gases stay in the chamber.
And then it didn't follow how you fabricate a dot in that way.
Oh yeah, so you basically you have a flux. So you have a flux of phosphine. So you're getting with the trimethyl indium, you get indium phosphide. And then when you want the dot, we want indium arsenide. So we switch off the phosphine gas. When I say we, it's the NRC.
Sure.
Then they switch to arsine. And then they can grow the indium arsenide. And then they go back to phosphine to cap the dot with,
right.
So you have a barrier material.
But that makes it sound as if the dot will be the entire diameter of the wire.
That's right.
But that's right. Okay,
yeah.
So the dot is the full cross-section of the wire.
Yeah.
The dot's not smaller than the wire.
So actually, if we left it like this, you would see no light. Because the dot would be right at here, the dot is the same diameter as this gold particle. And you would get no light because the dot's right at the surface where you have air or vacuum. And then it will quench the dot. You will have no emission. So you actually have to put a thin shell anyways to get light out. But we went one step further. We made more material around to get the waveguide.
So then once the whole thing's over, you just turn on.
So you switch the growth temperature. And then instead of growing from this gold particle, you grow from the the base, which is the substrate, and that's indium phosphide. And then you grow from there, and it actually grows like this. So now you see there's the core, and there's the shell around. So now we have a waveguide shell around the core and the duct. And then so now there's no tapering, right? You just see the waveguide. And this is maybe 2 microns high and 250 nanometers in diameter. You can then switch between both growth modes. You can go substrate growth or from the gold particle. And then so you can get something like this, where you have here's the core and here's the shell. And then if you actually switch between, you have to tune the parameters between both. And you can then make this nice smooth tapering towards the tip.
Yeah, I didn't quite follow that. So that to get the tapering, you're doing the growth from the substrate upwards. Is that
yes.
the idea? That you sort of turn it on.
Yeah.
And you do it many times until you only let it grow a certain distance up, and then you turn it on again, and it grows further.
And actually, the way it works is the indium diffuses up the wire, and there's only a certain diffusion length. So then you get this tapering for free, actually. This is not even optimized, really. It's what we got the first time. And the growers always wanted this tapering to get rid of it. They wanted nice straight wires, and we said, we want the tapering. It's really good for us. Yeah. And then just another important point is the crystal quality of the nanowire. We see that it's pure wurtzite. And actually, this crystal quality is really important, because if we have stacking faults, which means changes in crystal phases, this will also act as charge traps. And this will give us a fine structure splitting, which will reduce the entanglement, or it will give us photons that are not coherent. And we can see that, skip this slide, I think. So we can see the role of the crystal phase purity. So here's the case where we have a pure wurtzite wire. And here's where we have many stacking faults. And that's changes between zinc, blende, and wurtzite. And when we have this wire, we have an emission line width that's this black curve. And when we have a pure crystal quality, we get this very narrow emission line width that's two orders of magnitude smaller. And in this case, we have very coherent photons. And this crystal phase purity played a very important role. And this is the coherence of the single photons as a function of temperature. So we can see as we decrease the temperature, our single photon coherence is going to this nanosecond. And that's important for doing two-photon interference. So what about the entanglement fidelity? So here's the density matrix, and now we can see we're at the stage where we have entanglement fidelity of 98% for a 500 picosecond time window. And the concurrence is also very close to 1. And now we can compare, before we compare to parametric downconversion, I have the quantum oscillations that you were talking about earlier, going processing between the two exciton states. So what I've plotted here now is the correlations of psi plus Bell state and minus psi minus. So we see at 0 time delay, we're getting psi plus. And as the exciton is processing, we're going between psi plus and psi minus, and then back again. And what's interesting is when we take this peak, we have about 98% fidelity. When we look at the fidelity at this peak, it's 95%. And when it's here, it's still over 90%. So even though we have a small fine structure splitting, we see it processing. In actual fact, the entanglement fidelity is preserved during this exciton precession. And previous to this work, it was generally believed if you had a small splitting, your entanglement fidelity would be low. But now we're getting high entanglement fidelity, even with a small fine structure splitting, just because we have increased crystal quality and less dephasing mechanisms in the semiconductor. So we're investigating this now. What's the dephasing time of this two-photon state? But basically, you can imagine that this is processing because you're going from here to here. So you will get either LR plus RL or LL plus RR. That's why you're oscillating between the two. And I have a small movie where you can see this. So here you can see when we go to the first peak, you now see the entanglement going up. Or in this case, we had fidelity of about 95% with a concurrence of 90. And then you can see as it's oscillating, it goes to psi minus. You can see the density matrix on the bottom. And then it comes back above 80. And so we're maintaining the entanglement as it's oscillating. So you could, in principle, with an electro-optic modulator, follow these oscillations because it's a known period. And these exist.
So you're using the concurrence as your measure of entanglement?
Well, we look at fidelity and concurrence. Yeah.
So when you say fidelity, you mean fidelity to the maximum entangled state? Or do you mean fidelity?
Fidelity to RL plus LR. And then the concurrence, zero is no entanglement and one is perfect entanglement. And we're very close now. So now we can compare now what this work is compared to now the state of the art, what we already saw here. So this was all of the blue was the, just to remind you, blue is the parametric down conversion sources, and these were the quantum dot sources. So before I came to IQC, I was even recently here, but now the work that I showed you is now comparable to parametric down conversion. We can also do some post selections where we make the fidelity higher by throwing away some counts, and we can see we can get fidelity close to unity now, similar to parametric down conversion. And we see actually we follow very closely this curve. And there's actually a couple of things now we can do to get to this circle region where what I say define as on demand. So we can actually use electric field tuning to now reduce this fine structure splitting to zero. And we should theoretically go up to this circle region. Or another thing you can do, instead of tuning the fine structure splitting to zero, you can also follow these quantum oscillations between the two Bell states. You should also improve both the efficiency and the entanglement fidelity. And the other thing we can also do is go more resonant to reduce fluctuations in the solid state environment. It should also theoretically go from about this point to very close to unity. So these are things we're also going to try in the next years.
You didn't mention anything about the mirror. Did I misunderstand? You said that these best results are with the lying down configuration in the waveguide.
No, so here we have no mirror. So that's why our source efficiency is now only about 10%.
Right.
So if we added a mirror, we should also, go up here.
So the strategies you were describing for getting up there didn't seem to incorporate adding a mirror at all.
Yeah, that should also be added. Yes. Yeah, that's a good point.
Presumably to get up to the top corner, you need.
Yeah,
the
you still
well.
Need the mirror. Yes.
Yeah. Because otherwise you'd be down at, always bounded away from 50%. Like,
that's right. You would be bound.
You'd be under 0.5.
Yeah, you would be here.
In the mirror. Yeah.
Here, yeah. Which is about there. But we're now at the stage where we can cross over parametric down conversion and do experiments at, with more sources, because we can do faster acquisition times to characterize the entangled state.
So your source is brighter than parametric down conversion?
Yeah, it is. Yeah.
So there's an axis on this graph that you don't show.
I didn't, because this is basically from the last week or so. And so the data point I put here is even this point is post-selected, but we actually, where we are now is at 20%. So we're around here. And that should be somewhere here. But I think our fidelity for 20%, I think, is around 80, 87. So I think we're somewhere here.
So what I mean is here you have probably the best proposal per excitation pulse.
Yes.
But it's also important how many times you can send a pulse onto the
Yeah, that's right. So our lifetime is less than a nanosecond. So we could maybe go at 500 megahertz.
And presumably, is parametric down conversion similar? Or?
Yeah, it's similar, yes. Yeah. But right now, the experiments we're doing, we're operating at 80 megahertz. But we're just limited by the laser that we use. But if you can switch over to say electrically driven sources, then you can go faster.
Do you need as powerful a laser as
computer? No, we can use much less, yeah. Because in the end we have nanowatts of power, and our spot size is about a micron.
Because so there's very high efficiency, much high efficiency in your source of converting the incoming photon.
Yeah, you're converting the power more efficiently. That's right. And so so that would be a nice curve also to make, would be the fidelity times the count rate that you measure.
Yeah.
So basically useful photons.
Yeah, you want to get significant results in, say, the delta test, a useful source for it.
Yeah. So we did some Bell tests also, but not with these red points, but we did one with this one. And we had a violation of 36 standard deviations. And at lunch, Rob was saying we should also look at these ones. And we did the CHSH inequality.
And you can't do it because you have event ready.
Sorry?
Because CHSH sort of strictly speak well. You must still have a detection efficiency.
Right.
So you're still not closing the
Yeah, we're not closing any loopholes here.
Yeah. Ultimately, for many of the quantum information applications, rate is not as important as fidelity and efficiency. Because like in a Bell test, you want a lot of statistics, but if I'm doing like quantum money or something, I just need something, you know, in a single shot that works.
Right.
So in a way, even if your rate was less than parametric down conversion, that might be fine for the ultimate applications.
That's right. It's because we know that each time we would generate it, we would have a single pair. Yeah. But it's only recently that we're in. We can even think about going to this on-demand region.
You've drawn a circle there. Do you have some criteria that you'll sort of, once you satisfy, you'll declare victory?
Yeah, here?
Yeah, is it 50%? What's the...
Well, I did this. This was kind of like I was putting my company hat on when I drew this circle.
Right.
So You should take this circle with a grain of salt.
Yeah, sure.
But I basically would be happy if I would be in the circle, because that was my 5-year plan for the university. But I'm already here. Yeah. So I mean, maybe you guys have some. Now that we have this new source, maybe we can talk about some ideas. Yes.
So another problem that shows up in the parametric down conversion that I don't know if in those specific experiments, but I know that the guys in Rome have this problem, is that, I mean, as I was mentioning about the kind of spectral entanglement, if you produce two photons and they're spectrally entangled, they're never going to be very identical with any third photon that was not produced at that pair, right? So that translates into having photons that are not very identical. There's always some kind of in like some distinguishability that comes from some residual spectral entanglement between the pairs that are generating those.
So you make some entanglements, what, for example?
Yeah, anything, like even say if you're doing like boson sampling where you not really care about entanglement at all,
right,
but you just want the photons to be identical.
Yeah.
Even that's a problem because anyone who is entangled with someone who's not participating in the conversation is a little bit distinguishable from everyone else. So how does that, do you know like how these sources compare in terms of like photon distinguishability to the other, well, you know, kind of, if you had a third graph, a third line here in this kind of third axis, because,
mm-hmm,
you know, our photons are very distinguishable, very indistinguishable. You know,
oh yeah, so we did some photon indistinguishability and we get about 80% indistinguishability for the photons, for the single photons.
Mm-hmm.
And recently, people in the quantum dot community have shown 99% indistinguishability. And that's just by using an electric field to sweep out carriers in the charge environment. So you make your environment less noisy, and your spectral diffusion is less. So it's also theoretically possible to get near unity indistinguishability also with these structures, if we can use electric field. So it would serve two purposes. We would tune this fine structure to zero, but then we would also use it to sweep out the carriers in the charge environment. So that would be good for the entanglement swapping. Yeah.
It's the idea that ultimately the laser will be embedded in the chip and the whole thing can be integrated?
The ultimate goal would be to replace the nanowire with a PN junction so you can electrically drive it. So you would inject the carriers electrically.
Huh.
So you would not need the laser anymore.
Oh, I see. Yeah. And how far off is that? Is that part of the 5-year plan or is that a 10-year plan?
Yeah, that's more a 10-year plan because we just got to the stage where we had high quality entangled photons. And then adding dopants will then destroy our optical quality. So we would have to say, put the dot in an intrinsic region where it's separated from the dopants and then make the PN junction. Other people have made electrically driven entangled photons from Toshiba. Then in their case, they were in the high refractive index material and they had low efficiency. But they were able to make entangled photons, say, with 300 megahertz rep rate. Well, exciting, I mean.
So why is electrically driving preferred, given the trade-off to the dopants, why is that preferred to just driving it with laser?
You don't need the laser, the $100,000 laser to drive your source. So in our lab, it's not a problem, but say if you want to use it practically, it is. You wouldn't want a $100,000 laser for every source. How much time do I have left? Or?
You can come back.
Because then I can.
You can continue. Maybe another 5 minutes.
Okay, so if I have 5 minutes, I would just say one last thing. So I wanted to talk about the role of the nanowire symmetry. So the waveguide symmetry. So on the left, I have a case where we have a perfectly symmetric nanowire. This is a top view. So here you see the nanowire tip. And then you see as you go down, you see it getting bigger and bigger and bigger. And you see it's hexagon. And you see this is perfectly symmetric. But in this case, you see that the waveguide shell is asymmetric. And so how does this affect your entangled state that you observe? And it's actually very interesting. So we expect to see RL plus LR. So when we look in the different bases. If we look in the rectilinear bases, so what we're doing here is we're starting on the biexciton and stopping on the exciton, and we expect with very high probability that this happens, so you expect a bunching. And from the optical selection rules, you would expect VV, but we see in VH, and when we look at the circular base, we see the high probability of the exciton in the LL projection. So only in diagonal basis we see what we expect. And so this is we observe a different state. And this is actually because in the quantum states now most like HV plus VH. And this is because the waveguide shell is actually rotating the quantum state that we observe. And you can actually, then look at the nanowire, and basically if you take a nanowire that's maybe 5 microns long, you can actually see that the HH plus VV is transformed to this one, and RL plus LR is transformed to HV plus VH. And this is because birefringence, so as the entangled state is propagating along the wire, basically you have an effect, refractive index that's different in one direction compared to the other, and it basically rotates the phase of your entangled state, and you end up with this new entangled state at the end. So then when we look at the density matrix, we actually saw that we were entangled instead of the HH plus VV, it was entangled, it was most like HV plus VH, so we labeled it JJ plus WW, and then J was actually, so this was actually some elliptical state, so J was this one, and W was this one. So you can just think of it as an elliptical state. And then we can actually compensate for this birefringence. So what we did to compensate for the birefringence was we looked at the correlations in RR plus LL, and then we modified a quarter wave plate and a half wave plate, and we minimized the correlations in RR plus LL. And where we minimized these correlations, we would expect the maximum correlations in our normal state that we normally see, the HH plus VV. So we were actually able to fully compensate. So we started with 86, and we see now this VH transformed into LR, and the LL transformed into VV, and the diagonal stayed the same. So now we fully compensated for this birefringence when we have an asymmetric shell. And then we did this CH-SH inequality, which we can always talk about later if you're interested. And the result we got here was 2.25 when we took all the photons into account. We can go even higher violation if we do some post-selection. And so basically we have a new bright source of strongly entangled photon pairs for quantum information applications. So I showed you state-of-the-art photon pair efficiency and near unity fidelity if we do some post-selection, and we had a strong violation of the CHSH. And then the last slide I would like to show is basically the lab. So this is where when I started just less about a year and a half ago. And now this is my group here. And then here's the heart of the system. This is where we put our source. It's a closed cycle cryostat. We cool it to 4 Kelvin. And we can basically either excite from the side and collect from the top, or excite from the top and collect from the top. And basically now it's fully operational. The source is running. And yeah, I would like to thank you for your attention. So we have a, on the other side of this wall, we have a compressor, helium compressor.
Helium.
Yeah. And then it compresses the helium, it comes liquid, and then it passes this cold finger, and then it goes back as gas, and it recompresses. And actually what's unique about this cryostat is that it floats on the optical table, so the vibrations are on the order of 1 nanometer. And then it's basically, there's some bellows between the motor, so you isolate your sample from the motor that's cooling your sample. So it's a quite unique cryostat. It's the first in North America, this cryostat. And you can measure for weeks at a time without any alignment change. Yeah. And we have everything, the quantum state tomography is all automated. We can do things in measurements in 10 seconds per basis as compared to 10 hours before.
Yeah. Question, the birefringence effect. I'm sort of accustomed to thinking of birefringence as a property of the material. Why does an asymmetric geometry lead to birefringence?
Oh yeah, so one polarization direction will see a different waveguide diameter, So then it's a different refractive index between the two orthogonal polarizations. So you have a delta N, and then.
So the waveguide diameter determines the refractive index that's seen by the photon?
Yeah. Because you have some of the wave packet that leaks in the air.
Oh, I see. So like the width of the wave packet is bigger than the waveguide, and that's why the variation changes the.
Yeah.
Okay. See, and you can't eliminate that effect by making a larger wave packet because you're already set at the optimal diameter from earlier. You're telling us.
So from the first data I was showing, there was no birefringence. There we had a symmetric wire. But sometimes it just happens that the waveguide shell, it overgrows that circular opening, and then if it overgrows, it will sometimes rotate. And then as it rotates, then it expands out.
Right.
But that happens not all the time. So we basically have to look from... So at first, we actually measured the one with the birefringence first, and we weren't sure if it was birefringence. We saw the SEM images, and now we could also find wires that had no birefringence. Then it was a good case that it was birefringence.
Right.
Do you have just one sample inside there?
So there's thousands of wires on one chip.
Okay, and you're just focusing on one?
And then we're just focusing on one.
Right.
Yeah.
And how to get like that with thousands of wires, how long does that take?
To find a good one? You mean?
No, I mean even just the manufacturing or the fabrication process, how long did it take for the guys to do that?
Oh yeah, so the fabrication process you can do in a day. So just to give you an idea, when you're growing the wire it takes maybe 20 to 40 minutes to grow the full wire. But then the dot is grown for a few seconds. Yeah. And then we get the chip, and then we have to measure for a good optical quality. So it's not 100% yield. So each wire will have dot emission, but not everyone will be as nice as the one I showed you. So it's maybe right now it's maybe only 10 to 20% of the wires show nice emission like I showed you. And then you look for the brighter ones. But the probability of finding a good one is better than self-assembled dots, because they're grown randomly. And actually, I heard in China they look through 10,000 dots to find one good one for high indistinguishability. Whereas here we use e-beam lithography to position the dots where we want them. So in that sense, the yield's much higher. So they're more representative of the sample. But still, we have to get all those conditions right to get a bright sample. We have to have the good waveguide, the good tapering, and also a good internal quantum efficiency. Yeah.
The height at which the dot is placed on the wire, you obviously don't want it too close to the tip.
No.
Do you want it as close to the base as possible, or what determines?
So we put it in the waveguide section, and then we ended up putting it close to the base in case when we want a mirror, we want to put it at the antinode of the electric field. So it's easier to put it at the first antinode than look for higher orders. But at the base, near the base. Because it's also when you're growing the waveguide shell and tapering, it ends up being like 4 or 5 microns. But then the nanowire core was maybe 1 to 2 microns, so then it ends up being closer to the base, also by design.
More questions? Thanks a lot.
You're welcome.
I like some of the talk because people